Welcome to Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news, trends, and hottest topics that focus on advances in cybersecurity and cyber industry economics. Our expert yet down-to-earth hosts make cybersecurity straightforward. They ask the tough questions and make this challenging topic something that everyone can understand. Our candid approach lets guests open up on topics we would all like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at newcyberfrontier.com. That's www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join today's host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
Well, hello everybody, and thank you so much for joining us. My name is Mickey Cockrell. I'm with the National Cybersecurity Center, and we are just absolutely thrilled to join NCF for yet another episode. This is so exciting. I am joined here actually by a couple of my colleagues, Forrest Sinti and Maddie Gullickson, also with National Cybersecurity Center. And we are just going to be talking about a very relevant and timely topic here in 2020. But I want to go ahead and introduce first Forrest and Maddie. Forrest, tell me a little bit about yourself. What brought you to NCC, and give me a little information about your background.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Mickey. So a little bit about my background. So I've spent about 7 years working in a combination of IT and kind of tech roles, variety of tier one, tier two, and other cyber-related skill sets. But I actually ended up transitioning into working more in kind of public relations and kind of publicly focused, like a policy role, where I was a contractor with the Secretary of State's office working on Go Code, as well as kind of working with assorted small businesses and governments in a variety of things, from public relations to just general marketing. And all of that kind of came together when the NCC was looking for a project manager related to elections. It was something I hadn't done before, but it had some experience in the policy realm, just working on different related topics, and kind of got in and kind of got to work at the intersection of tech and policy and, you know, learning about a new topic, elections.
Very cool. And you are now the Director of Business and Government Initiatives at the NCC.
That's right.
Oh, excellent. Maddie, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, and I just joined in the NCC about 6 months ago as a new project manager for Secure the Vote program. And my background is in state and local politics and government. So I worked in Governor Hickenlooper's office for a few years and came back home to Colorado Springs and was able to work in as the assistant elections manager for El Paso County, as well as in the mayor's office for Colorado Springs. So
very cool.
Very excited to be here.
Awesome. So you guys have a awesome diverse background between the two of you. And today we're going to be talking a little bit more about something that you mentioned, Secure the Vote. So for all of our listeners who might not know Secure the Vote, what exactly is that? Forrest, maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So the Secure the Vote project and like the program itself really emerged from a combination of Colorado state and local officials coming together, asking the question around how are overseas voters voting right now? Historically, in the past, there's states all across the U.S. that use a combination of methods, whether it's email or fax or mailing their ballot overseas. But the question came from former Secretary of State Wayne Williams, along with other people like Amber McReynolds and Sarah Johnson, who are big on the election world. And they just posed the question, is there a way to do this better, and can we make it as secure as possible? And that was kind of the initial problem statement that we worked from when we started this program. Under Maddie's leadership, it's kind of blossomed from there. So you can, if you want to talk a little bit about some of the things that you've been up to.
Yeah, so we're continuing to look at the entire ecosystem of election security. And so we believe that it's critical to look at and focus on how we can improve the security of overseas voters and disabled voters in our population. And so we are really aggressively pushing for standards and guidelines in that area. And that's been a pretty exciting push. But in addition to that, we're also tackling misinformation and disinformation campaigns with really as they relate to elections. And also, how do we help election officials become more aware and have the tools to really address some of those things and just overall cybersecurity issues as well? Because we believe that the weakest link is the biggest vulnerability to our election system, and so we need to make sure that we help support as many of our election officials as possible.
That's great. And how would you say that Secure the Vote is related to NCC?
Sure. So I think the biggest thing is that the NCC's biggest mission is all about securing the world. And one of the big things that we have to say when we relate back to the Secure the Vote program is that we believe if we can secure the vote, then we can secure the world, because democracy is a fundamental principle in our society. And increasing the confidence and trust in the election system is something that is a noble cause in some ways. But ultimately, if we go back to kind of a simplified version of that, the NCC is all about innovation and awareness. And this program is really focused on driving innovations in elections and providing awareness to the big issues facing the election system. So.
That's great. Thank you for that great answer. I want to dive into them more, but first, here's a word from all of our sponsors.
Land, sea, air, space, cyber. It's a domain. It's a place. It's a location. We've got to learn to operate there. You've got an awful lot of energy, entrepreneurial, technological, educational energy, not just in government, but in the private sector, in organizations like NCC, that are going out there, creating alliances, creating connective tissue between different elements of our society as we all learn how to deal with this new domain.
And we are back. Thank you again to everyone who's joining us today. We are speaking with Forrest Senti, Director of Business and Government Initiatives with NCC, and Maddie Golix, and the Project Manager also at NCC. Again, my name is Mickey Cockrell. I'm the Marketing Manager at NCC. And we are diving into Secure the Vote. We were talking a little bit about your background and what Secure the Vote is. You know, one of the topics that comes up so often that we will be discussing today is electronic voting. And I'm really curious, what is one thing that most people don't realize about electronic voting?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is that most of us, when we're thinking about elections, we're thinking about what we're going to do election day. We're going to get up, we're going to head to the polls in Colorado or a few other states. You might be thinking about how you're going to sit over a nice cup of coffee or shot of whiskey like I do and think about how you're going to vote for your mail-in ballot, and you'll drop it off at a drop box or mail it back in. But there are millions of U.S. citizens overseas who are serving in our armed forces or might be missionaries, might be corporate employees, for whom that concept of getting a ballot and returning that ballot is not as simple. And really that's one of the biggest things. When we talk about election integrity, I think we need to be thinking about it not just in a security standpoint, but from a standpoint that if we don't have as many people who have that fundamental right to vote participating in the system, our elections they're not fully fully secure.
Yeah.
And so it's a public participation aspect that really drives a lot of that security as well. And so when we talk about electronic ballot return or electronic ballot delivery, there are millions of U.S. citizens every year that are not they don't have the easiest way to return a ballot.
Wow.
And currently, in the midst of COVID, we're really realizing that as over 180 countries are stopping their international mail system. So even for all of those citizens that might be used to sending a mail ballot back, which is still not the most efficient way, overseas mail, they're not going to have that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so then they're left with the option of email or fax. And there are no requirements for that email or that fax to be encrypted. And so when we are talking even further about actual security, what we mean by, you know, a traditional sense of security, it's not secure. That's one of those things that we forget a lot about overseas voters, but they're, a lot of them are the ones that are fighting for that fundamental right to vote, and a lot of them are left out of the process.
Wow. So let's break it down a little bit. Let's take it back to a definition. What exactly is electronic voting?
Yeah, so traditionally ballots are paper ballots, right? That's what we're all used to going into the polls with. Mm-hmm. Or like I said, you might be sitting at home with a mail ballot. Electronic voting can be broken down into kind of two basic definitions. Election offices can either be allowed to offer an electronic ballot to a voter. So again, this is really in that context of overseas voters primarily, where they'll attach essentially an email attachment of the ballot, and they'll send it off. Or you get the electronic ballot return, and these are some of the more technical terms, but it's important because we kind of lay a blanket overall of this mobile voting. So then, similarly, that voter can print off that ballot and fill it in and submit it again as an email attachment or a scan, or a fax, or mail it. And so those are some of the different ways that we talk about when we're thinking about electronic voting. But currently today, and that's part of what we've been working on is Secure the Vote, is there are several new technologies that are emerging to try and make that process more secure and more accessible. And cool. Some of those include blockchain voting on an app, or using a web portal that's secure and submitting a ballot through that. So those are the now newly added definitions to electronic ballot voting.
And I'm curious, one of the questions I feel like comes up all the time is there a paper ballot trail for electronic voting?
Yeah, so not on the front end, obviously, because you're using technology. But when it comes to how that ballot is counted, it doesn't matter which technology you're using. They're going to be printing, those election officials are going to be printing off that ballot and the ballot image, and they scan and tabulate that. So there is actually a paper trail on that, from that aspect.
Wow, very cool. So Forrest, could you clarify a little bit, who exactly is allowed to return ballots?
Sure, yeah. So I think it's first good to acknowledge that there is no state in the U.S. that is considering or looking at allowing for the entirety of the everyday population to vote electronically. Between polling, being at the polls places, and voting by mail are the main ways that people vote in the U.S. today, and that's probably not going to change in the near future. But what's important to start with is to talk about the few different categories of voters and the different laws that kind of relate to each of those. So the first one, which is the one that Maddie touched on, has to do with overseas voters. So overseas voters have what's called the UACAVA Act, which is the Uniformed Overseas Citizens and Absentee Voting Act. And that act has to do with basically guaranteeing overseas citizens the right to vote electronically. So this represents, almost, depending on the year, 5 to 7 million U.S. citizens that live abroad, and a group of people who the average voter turnout rates hovers around 7%. And that stayed consistent since the act was created. Mm-hmm. So even if you provide more options, it's still difficult for them just because of the nature of, we're talking about missionaries in Uganda, soldiers in Kandahar. It's difficult. Mm-hmm. But to talk about the states, I think what's important to say, who is allowing the remote voting. So you have the overseas citizen, you have the disabled population. That's a broad term. Mm. In most states now, disabled is a self-acknowledgement. You don't actually have to provide a doctor's note or any of that kind of stuff. A lot of states in the South, and even some in the Midwest and some in the North, do make you have a doctor's note, but the disabled population broadly is now becoming the next area where electronic voting is allowed, because a lot of these people, it's difficult. It creates a barrier for them to get to a poll place to vote because they have to, if they have a physical enablement, they have to physically get to there and then vote and potentially wait in line. And especially with COVID now, they might put themselves at risk physically being there in person. The other two categories are kind of a mix, and it varies state by state how the laws kind of define them, and that's absentee and emergency voting. So absentee would be, hey, I'm not going to be in the state during this time frame. I'm going to be in a neighboring state, and I can get mail. Or in some extreme cases, like the emergency ballot I was talking about. Like in Colorado, they do allow you, I think it's within 48 hours of the election or 24 hours, like if you end up in the hospital with a crazy emergency accident or even in jail. Mm-hmm. They're allowed to, you can transmit your ballot online. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of these different cases where people have the ability to transmit their votes electronically, but it's not uniform. Because in my opinion, one of the cool things about the United States is that we are a distributed election system in its nature. It's 50 states with 10,000 jurisdictions, and nobody does it the same. It's actually one of the big reasons why we naturally have a good defense against foreign adversaries, is because this state is not going to be building their infrastructure in the same way as this state. But it also, back to Maddie's point again, shows why it's important to look at the security piece of it, because the weakest link in the chain, you know, kind of demonstrates a flaw in the entire system.
Right.
So that difference is also our weakness and our strength. But I think the biggest thing to say is, you know, there's four states in the U.S. that allow using a web-based portal, Colorado being one of them right here.
Okay.
You know, one state used a mobile voting app for statewide elections, and that'll change this year as well as many others between West Virginia, Delaware, Oregon, Utah, and Colorado, among others.
Oh, wow.
And then I think the other thing, too, is that there's 19 states that allow for you to use email or fax. And even some, you know, that don't allow ballot transmission. There's an equal number of states that allow it and don't allow it, 19 and 19. So it's all over the place, but it really does vary state by state. It's not a federal, outside of the UACOV Act, it's not federally mandated that you have to for disabled absentee or emergency or the average person.
Okay. So I want to dive into that a little bit more, but first, a word from my sponsors.
Murray Security Services are your cybersecurity experts with decades of experience providing professional training services for our clients in various industries. We offer professional training and certification in areas of cybersecurity, safety, health, and environmental services at our academy. Our in-person and online training provides a collaborative environment where students can interact directly with instructors through live chats or in private classrooms. Visit MurraySecurityServices.com for more information.
And we are back again. My name is Mickey Cockrell with NCC, and I am joined by Forrest Cinti and Maddie Golix, and we are just diving into a conversation about secure the vote, electronic voting, what exactly that means. And Forrest, before the break, we were talking a little bit about you know, who exactly is allowed to return ballots electronically. And you mentioned some of the states that actually have web portals.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious. What pilots does Secure the Vote and NCC participate in?
Sure. So, you know, to kind of take a step back, you know, we've largely worked with just two voting companies in doing these pilots. And the way that we do these pilots is we have a partnership with Tess Montgomery Philanthropies. They're a high-level strategic partner of ours that helps us to fund a lot of these. Our big goal, and as we kind of learn and begin to adapt to this technology, is that it doesn't come at any cost to the taxpayer to actually use the technology. As we kind of get to a place of either acceptance or validation, or, you know, to use startup terms, like, you know, like these software companies are going to have vulnerabilities and we want to expose the flaws and remediate them before this becomes a national kind of phenomena, so you could say. But the two companies we work with are called Votes and Democracy Live. We work with these companies in various states, including Colorado, Utah, Oregon, Washington, West Virginia, Delaware, and potentially going into the fall more that we can talk about later. And the biggest thing when we focus on these pilots is that they enable a different range of audiences. When we did our first pilot with Votes here in Colorado in the city county of Denver, that one was just for overseas voters. And that one, you know, had a range, I think it had a little over 300 votes in total that came through on that. And, you know, overwhelmingly the people that used it liked it and the voter turnout rate increased. So a lot of good things. But in other states, we've been able to try different things. So in West Virginia and Delaware, we've used it for the disabled populations, and it's enabled them to have a lot more privacy, kind of in their, in the presence of their own home to be able to vote, which has been unique. Because I think one of the aspects of cybersecurity that gets overlooked is cybersecurity isn't just the digital security of, you know, things connected to the internet. It's also psychological. It's also physical. And in some cases, it's also societal. So privacy, from my personal opinion, is one of the single biggest things that cybersecurity can enable when you focus on it as a topic. So allowing people that are disabled to vote privately in their own home, even if they're blind, deaf, or disabled, is something that's that's helpful in this world. Because in previous times, whenever they go into a polling station, I've heard horror stories in different states all over the U.S. They go in and the machines are broken, or the staff isn't properly trained. And what ends up happening is they have to sign an affidavit where somebody has to mark their ballot for them, and they're verbally telling them who they're voting for. So you remove the aspects of privacy from the equation. And this is a physical process where, yes, you can't hack a piece of paper, but a different aspect of this whole equation is kind of being looked at. But to go back a little bit, I think one of the unique pilots that we did, too, besides the disabled and overseas population, was in Washington. We worked with King County, which is one of the largest voting districts, if not the largest, I think, up until LA. We'll take it over this year, I think, for voting. And we actually did a general population test using Democracy Live, where we were able to, you know, with almost 6,000 voters, we doubled the historic turnout for this conservation district, where historically people had to show up for one day and turn in their vote, you know, very quickly, and it would cost the district a tremendous amount of money to do it. But in this way, they were able to open it up for 2 weeks and people could submit their ballot electronically, and people loved it. We literally doubled, like number for number, almost doubled voter turnout, which never happens in elections. You don't double turnout. you might increase it a little, but you never double. So
you mentioned a few numbers in there in regards to a couple of the pilots, but how many ballots are we talking about?
A very, very small amount.
Okay.
We're talking in total working on this for the past, our first pilot was in May of last year to today, so about a year and some change. All in total, less than 10,000 votes total. And a combination of municipal primaries, special elections, all that kind of stuff.
Very cool. And I'm curious, Mandy, who actually creates the technology to enable electronic voting?
Yeah, so as Forrest mentioned, there are a few primary industry partners that we've worked with, Democracy Live and Votes. They've developed really different ways of approaching this. So Votes is an actual mobile app. And so people can download the application, and then there's various facial recognition technology that's used to ensure that that person is who they say they are. And then they go ahead and vote, submit their ballot. One of the beautiful things about that system is that the voter gets a receipt of the ballot that they've submitted, and then all of that is anonymized through and secured safely through blockchain, so that one of the things that we work on with Votes is conducting a citizen audit of those votes. So anybody, including those voters and any U.S. citizen, can go through and look and compare the ballot image of the receipt that a voter received, and then the ballot image of the ballot that was stored, and then ultimately the scanned image of what the election office prints off and tabulates, to make sure that those three things are the same thing, and that there hasn't been any interference. And it's still not a perfect system, but it's one of the things that really lends itself to a close to an end-to-end verification, vote verification system. Which is that's the gold standard, and that's what we want to get to. But that's one of the methods. And then, as we mentioned, Democracy Live is a secure online voting platform. Mm-hmm. And so people can access it via tablet, email, cool. Or tablet, computer, their phone, and they just simply log in, click who they want to click, and select and submit, and you're done.
Very cool.
And so those are some pretty those are the standards currently, but the exciting part about this space is that we need to be thinking innovatively in our election system, and these are some of the pioneers that are, and we believe that it is incredibly important to make sure that those that we're given some space and some allowance for curiosity in this to actually make sure that the U.S. system remains one of the best places to vote across the world.
So you mentioned a couple ways, but are there any other ways that folks can return ballots electronically?
Yeah, so as we mentioned before, I mean, there's email or fax. But again, neither of those systems are required to be encrypted by any means. And so that's where we say, there are still concerns, and there are still issues that need to be worked out on in both of those, for both of these different technologies. But let's just be honest about the entire conversation, and that we're not mandating that people who are submitting ballots via fax or email are having to encrypt their ballots. And so the security risk for that to be interfered with is extremely significant, where you could have somebody hack into somebody's email and send a ballot in a different language or with different selections than they thought they had or something like that. And that just really, when Forrest talked about the psychological security, that undermines the sense of security of the system. And that's what we're really trying to prevent. So, again, it's not a perfect system yet, but we believe it's critical that we move in this direction and we be working on these things and thinking about these things to make sure that it is for the time when we are ready to move to that next level.
Gotcha. Sorry, a little bit of a brain fart. We can edit that out, right?
And you know you what I realized great. Is that you need to, like, not move the camera. And
when you're touching the desk,
it's moving the camera.
Okay. So I'll keep my hands down here.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll get it.
Okay, great. So 3, 2, 1. So Forrest, Maddie touched on it a little bit, but I'm curious, I'm sure many folks have questions. What are some of the risks to returning ballots electronically?
Sure. So I think it's important to step back and acknowledge why, you know, the NCC and like we were created this whole program in the first place, is that it's not that we necessarily believe that mobile voting, electronic voting will be the single greatest thing since sliced bread. It's that we know that people want to move in this direction and that there will be risks and vulnerabilities involved. And because of the way that the election infrastructure is set up in the United States, there's not a lot of oversight over these technologies. There's not a lot of groups who are actively working to make these as best as possible. Historically in the U.S., election technology companies, because we live in a capitalist economy, are for-profit-driven enterprises. So these companies, their bottom line is driven by, okay, we can produce this product for X dollars, we will make this much, and we're going to go after contracts in these states. And that's how it works. And that's okay, because that's how the rest of our economy works. But in this specific space, there's only one part of the entire election system that's regulated by any kind of, you know, policy or, you know, or guideline, and that's the tabulation system. So in elections, the tabulation system is where once your ballots have been reviewed and counted and, you know, all these different things, there's a machine that it goes through that actually records the actual number of votes to this candidate or that candidate. And that's the only device in the entire system that's actually federally regulated on how that device is supposed to be built, manufactured, tested, the whole nine yards, right? Everything else in the election system is quite literally the Wild West. There are some best practices that people can follow. And the big reason why I'm excited we're on this podcast is because, you know, a lot of people in this space who work in healthcare understand HIPAA and the related guidelines that they force you to use when it comes to the healthcare system and managing people's data. If you work in banking or any kind of money, they understand KYC compliance and the different things that you have to do in order to transfer money across the web. Go into different spaces. Anything involving identity, there's ISO standards related to it. You just keep going down the line. You're going to handle customer information, got to be PCI compliant, right? And there's all these different spaces across the entirety of our economy where we have these regulations in place to not only protect the company from the liability, hey, if you're going to do this kind of work, you need to be at this level of security, but it also protects us as citizens because we like banking online. We like, you know, the movement to have our medical records moved electronically. Like, we like these different things. But the good thing is that the government and the industry itself are moving towards regulation of these things to make sure the companies entering the space know, hey, by the way, you need to have this level of security before you're even allowed to play.
Right.
In this ecosystem, that's not how it is. It's entirely hacktivist. It's entirely community-driven. It's entirely, you know, people who are coming from the security industry who are coming into it and saying, I can build something that can work for this, right? I've had several conversations with people. So to go to the core of what the risks are for returning ballots electronically, I can name off a list of things. Man-in-the-middle attacks, you know, the device security itself, what you're transmitting on, you know, the ability to compromise information on the server side, SQL inject. I mean, all these different things that you can think of. If you're a business security audience, anything you think of where you can tack a web-based or application-based technology, you can do it on this stuff. But the bigger risk is what Maddie said earlier, which is that there's no standards or guidelines at the federal level, and that there is no community standard to enforcing these people and these technologies to actually have to enforce a minimum level of security needed to do this. And that's the biggest risk because, like what Maddie said again, a single vote being compromised shakes the entire confidence of what you're doing. Look at Iowa. I mean, it was literally weeks until people felt comfortable saying XYZ person won the election.
Right.
And so imagine that on a national scale for a presidential election. Be a catastrophe.
Yeah.
So we have to work towards addressing the risks and finding ways to prevent them before it even becomes a concern.
And how are those risks addressed?
Just to hammer at home, standards and guidelines. Mm-hmm. And I hate to say it, but a really involved and supportive community that wants to make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
We need people actively finding flaws. MIT recently came out reports with two of the companies that we work with where they went through and they reverse engineered the application and said, hey, we found these different flaws and this is the things that you need to change. Whether the intent of that was to stop it from happening or not, maybe, I don't know. I don't personally know the professor that did it. But it's actually a good thing in my mind because that provides a blueprint. Hey, company, here's a bunch of things that you should go fix. And here's a blueprint. They didn't have to pay for that. So,
right.
So, yeah.
And I want to get into a question for both of you, what you both think is the biggest opportunity and also the biggest challenge ahead. But first, we'd love to hear a word from our sponsors.
Oh, gosh, I'm sorry. That would have been the end of
it. Oh, that's the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
End.
So
we have to wrap up.
That's okay. Just
sorry.
Pick it up.
Oh, you're good.
We'll,
so
we'll edit that out. It's not a problem.
No worries. So maybe we could do like
a wrap.
We'll go
so
back.
We have like 30 seconds.
Though. Yeah, I was going to say 30
don't worry
seconds.
About it. Just whatever you need.
Okay.
Okay, great. So yeah, we can okay. We'll talk about that question.
I'll be sure.
Then,
I'm just going to reiterate what I said.
And then how to get involved. Okay. All right. So
do you just want to did you ask for both of us in the phrasing of that?
That question.
You were going to.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just going to reiterate what I just said, just quickly.
Because I think I'm just going to say, yeah, standards and guidelines are both the biggest opportunity and the challenge.
So maybe switch it and just say any closing thoughts as we end?
Yeah, any closing thoughts. And then you guys can just talk about it. And then quickly, how can we get involved?
So we can cut it back to where you asked for both of them to give some.
Yeah, exactly. We can cut before that. Yep, good catch.
Okay.
Okay, everyone ready? Okay, great. So we find ourselves at the end of our time, but I'm curious, what are any closing thoughts you might have about electronic voting, secure the vote, anything we've talked about?
So, very quickly, the reason I got into elections is because I had a conversation with a woman when I was in college in Egypt, an older woman who asked me what it was like to vote freely. And that question and that conversation will never, never leave me. And so I think as closing thoughts around the election, we just want more people to be involved in the conversation because this thing is so fundamental and it's so critical to our way of doing life here in America, but it's also a hope to people across the world. Mm-hmm. My biggest hope is that over the next few years, we're able to establish some additional guidelines and standards to really make this a secure option for people, whether it stays just for overseas voters and disabled voters, or whether it gets applied other places, that this maintains that overall approach and passion for election integrity that marks the U.S. system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to build off of that, I think the biggest thing for me as a passion for this piece is, you know, my dad served in the military for almost 30 years. Never voted once the entire time because he wasn't able to. And then I hear stories like with the groups we got to work with, like the 107-year-old woman in Utah who was able to vote, you know, for the first time from the privacy of her home in over 20 years. You know, we have all these different stories where this technology can enable good. But we can't get there until we get the entire community to establish that, hey, these are the ways that if this is going to happen, this is how. And that hasn't happened yet. And that's the ultimate goal. Like, the security community knows that they can break things. My favorite story when I was in DEF CON last year was the little waitress robots that were around the casino. And within 24 hours, the entire community took them over and had them running into walls and like doing all kinds of funny stuff. And that, they weren't supposed to do that, but it was awesome. But I know that when that community puts their mind to it and decides that this is something they want to get involved in and make it better, it does.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my big closing thought.
Powerful words from both of you. Last question, if listeners want to get involved or learn more, how can they do that?
So if you're interested at all in participating in the citizen audits, we are always looking for people to participate. So you can just go online, cyber-center.org, and look us up and get involved that way. And I think there are a few other ways as well.
Yeah. So if you're a corporation, a foundation, or even an individual with a lot of security expertise, you can reach out to us to either help support the movement in terms of, you know, whether it be just funding or even in kind of work. We've talked with pen testing companies and different groups in the past who have offered to provide services to some of these kind of nascent companies in the past. But the biggest thing is just to reach out and get involved. It doesn't have to be money. It doesn't have to be any kind. It could just be time or your expertise. We've learned so much talking with the community, and we don't want that to end. So.
Great. For us, Maddie, I want to thank you so much for your time, and a thank you to all of our listeners for joining us today. Forrest mentioned a few ways to get involved, so we hope that you will join us. Until next time, we'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to New Cyber Frontier. Remember to follow or like our post and circulate each new show to your networks. We keep you informed, bring you the latest news, explore new trends, and find the hottest topics. With New Cyber Frontier, you don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert. Just get plugged in. We encourage you to get involved. Tell us what topics interest you and join our mailing lists. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. That's newcyberfrontier.com. Check out our previous interviews and please let us know if there are any topics that you would like to hear discussed. See you next time on New Cyber Frontier.